Session number 10059.
Sir Geoffrey Cox, reel 4.
I think the other major point about Madrid in my time is, of course, it was the setting in the middle of November for the first bombardment of a civilian city from the air by night, and the first demonstration to the world of this dread instrument of aerial bombardment, which we all were scared of, and which really dominated military and political thinking to an excessive degree at that time, that this was the period of the bomber will always get through, and the assumption that there'd be 30,000 dead within London within the first week. And people forget now how powerful that feeling was, and the first air raids on Madrid got extraordinary attention in the papers, understandably, because everybody was asking themselves, is this what's going to happen to us? There were, of course, severe casualties, but at the end of the day, they were had no effect on the war morale at all, and no effect on the front. The aerial bombardment on the front, on the other hand, did have a marked effect. I mean, I was wrong when I gave the impression that the bombardment of the cities had no effect, and it had no reaction on the front, but air power was used with considerable effect in the early stages of the war, and right throughout the war in Italy, in Spain, and of course it was there the Germans developed and to a considerable degree the technique of the dive bomber, which they used on the Ebro.
Did you have much contact with the political differences between the Spanish political parties whilst you were there?
Very little. That was because, of course, Madrid was ruled by the junta, the military junta, while I was there, and was really effectively ruled by the Communist Party as by far the most dominant group within the military high command, the military group. And the political differences had moved away to Valencia. And indeed, I can remember being astonished in my third day in Madrid when there was a government reshuffle, and there was passionate interest shown by people who knew much more about Spain than I did about the relative shifting of ministries between one party and another. I think my view was that the capital is about to fall. All these people will be running for their lives and probably bolting over the frontier. And it doesn't seem to me to matter much whether you bolt over the frontier as an undersecretary or as a full-scale minister. But of course I was wrong. This was the shifts of power within the government, which remained very important right up to the end of the war, and in which Negrín ultimately came through as the really as the instrument of the Communist Party. And one had reached the stage by the end of the war in which, had the Republic won the war, I'm afraid it would have emerged as the equivalent of an East European post-war government with however many parties. Ultimately, the power was in the hands of the communists. I think I made that point at the Imperial War Museum discussion, and I think that I was vigorously counterattacked by everybody else there, but I produced all sorts of arguments to prove that the communists had said they would do nothing of the sort. But I don't think one can deny that they would have kept the reins of power strongly in their hands.
So you didn't really see much of the anarchists and the PUM and so on whilst you were in Madrid?
I saw nothing of the PUM. I saw quite a lot of the anarchists because they sent a column under Cerruti to Madrid while I was there, and they fought very bravely but very erratically, and at one stage, of course, opened up the front to Franco when they they collapsed in the square just to the south of the university city, not through lack of courage, but through lack of organization. But mainly, my contacts with them were on an informal basis on my way back to the British Embassy in the evening. I used to drop into an annex to a school which served as an anarchist headquarters, where they had abundant food and where they'd obviously pillaged everything in sight, and where we used to get a splendid cut of ham and some hot beans before going home. But that was my only formal contact with them.
I'm intrigued by Sefton Delma because of the role that he later played in the propaganda war in the Second World War. What did you make of him as a person?
Well, Delma was an original man, not at all a man with an original mind. He was not at all a man with a politically doctrinaire mind of any kind. Delma was intensely interested in people and in individuals. And it was very brave of him to come to Spain. He came to Spain when William Forrest, who had been their correspondent, was withdrawn and had a row with the Express, and the Express found themselves without a correspondent. And Delma came into Madrid. Now, this was a brave thing to do because he had reported from Germany at the time of the rise of Hitler and had traveled round Germany in Hitler's aeroplane and it was on close personal terms with Hitler and Goering and others. It was assumed that he was pro-Nazi. He was not pro-Nazi, but the chances that he might have had a bullet in his back when he went to call on people like the Talman Battalion was really considerable. And but because he was fascinated by people as individuals, therefore he very rapidly became full of respect for the International Brigade and got on very well with these people like Ludwig Renn, and ultimately became certainly sympathetic to the Spanish Republic while remaining essentially a maverick conservative. And when the Germans came into the war, Delma was absolutely vigorous and eager to do anything he could. And of course he had then this remarkable gift that he had grown up as a schoolboy in Berlin, where his father had been a professor of English at the military academy, spoke absolutely perfect German, and was therefore in the perfect position to do propaganda against them.
So he never showed any apprehension that you could see about getting a bullet in his back?
No, he was... Delma was a brave man, and he was a very big man, of sort of Falstaffian figure, was at this time in Madrid, he and I were very good friends. Later, we got rather at odds with one another because he was, in particular, he was prepared to go along with Beaverbrook's belief that war would not happen, since I was equally convinced that war was going to happen. This tended at times to get us into rather acrimonious arguments. But I think also Delma, I think, regarded me as taking too academic a view of affairs in Europe, and I regarded Delma as not really looking at the great forces that were loose, but seeing the whole thing in terms of a lot of individuals facing up to a lot of other individuals. But Delma retained to the end of his journalistic days an eye uninhibited by ideology, which I, on the whole, rather respected. I think he was wrong in the 39 in believing with Hitler that at the end there would be no war, but with Beaverbrook, but otherwise I think his judgment was good.
You've already said a little bit about atrocities, but what's your judgment about atrocities in view of what you actually personally witnessed in Spain?
Well, I witnessed nothing of that I could prove, and I think if I'd been there longer, I would have then been drawn into reporting them, and I think probably I would have found myself excluded from... I like to think I would have done that. It is quite... But the truth is, in a war, caught up in a war, and this was a war which I wanted the Republic to win, because I felt that if Hitler and Mussolini won, then they had one more powerful bastion against us. In a war, you tend to avert your gaze from things which are damaging to your side. When I came to write my book of the Defense of Madrid, which I took to Gollancz because he was the only chap who was prepared to bring a book out quickly, I put in a chapter on atrocities, saying there had been atrocities, which I'd heard of at second hand, and also describing the spectacle of these chaps in the model prison going after what was their death. And Gollancz tried to get me to take it out, and I said no, I will not take it out. And he said, well, you know, you want the Spanish Republic to win the war, so do I. If I, Gollancz, publish a book which say there are atrocities on the Spanish Republican side, then be trumpeted around the world that this is proof there are. And I said, well, the fact is that you can't, if I don't put that in, I invalidate everything else I've written, because anybody of any quality who's been in Spain knows there have been widespread killings by the Republican side, and that to deny them is to distort the picture. And I'll say this for Gollancz, that the chapter is there, he accepted it. The only change I made at his demand was that when I had described La Passionaria on the outskirts of Getafe rallying the troops, that I said this must have been the same sort of scene that you saw with Trotsky on the outskirts of Leningrad. And Victor Gollancz said, I'm a little uneasy about this word Trotsky. Do you think you could change it? And with what I hope is heavy irony, I said, would you like me to say Stalin? And Gollancz said, well, you don't need to go as far as that, but if you'd like to, I'd be very happy to see it. And I said, well, I think I'll just leave it out altogether. So
how did it appear?
It appeared as this is the way Bolshevik leaders...
Could you tell me where exactly you went to whilst you were in Spain? Was it just in the Madrid area?
I was only in the Madrid area because, of course, the whole story at the time I was there. The Basque fighting had not yet begun. And when I came out from Madrid in mid-December 1936, I was under the impression I was coming out just for a leave before I went back again, but... By the time I'd got out, all the stars of the News Chronicle, who had been deemed to be rightly too grand to be locked up if Franco captured Madrid, were then all eager to come. And you had Philip Jordan, Vernon Bartlett, A.J. Cummings, Dennis Weaver, whom I'd replaced there, and William Forrester had by this time joined the News Chronicle, so that I found myself at the end of a long list with no chance of getting back at all. And when the fighting took place in the Basque country, I begged the Chronicle to send me there, and they didn't, and they had no reporter to cover Guernica. They relied entirely upon the reporting of what actually was a very good, honest account by the daughter of the masters of one of the British ships in Bilbao, Fifi Roberts. But for a paper like the News Chronicle, which was on the forefront of this battle, to be citing the reports of Fifi Roberts on Guernica exposed them simply to the most monumental ridicule. And I was so angry at that that I resigned and went to the Daily Express, who posted me to Vienna. So I never got back to Spain, unfortunately.
You were there from October to December.
Yes, I was there. And the only thing about that is that was the peak of the First Battle of Madrid. Madrid could have fallen on three occasions. It could have fallen then. It could have fallen when they tried to drive round and cut the Valencia Road at the Rama River. And it could have fallen if the attack down through Guadalajara had been successful. But the first of those was the first and the second were the only two in which Franco had a real chance. And therefore, my knowledge of the Spanish Civil War is restricted to a knowledge of the defense of Madrid in the autumn of 36.
Was there a change in atmosphere in Spain, Republican Spain, over that period of 2 or 3 months?
Within Madrid itself, the change you had was of a degree of war weariness, that the exaltation of the early days, the sudden realization that they could hold the city, this marvelous feeling that swept through, just through Spain, but through the whole Western world, that fascism was not unstoppable, until then, at every point, it had seemed that they just had to push and people gave way to them, and here was an occasion when they hadn't. Had begun to fade away. You had a long, bitter winter ahead of you. You had the prospect of a really hard grind, but at the time I left, it was still the mixture of the desperation and the exaltation of successful defense.
We were talking earlier off the record about the attitude of young people today towards the Spanish Civil War. Could we put what we said on tape now?
Well, happily, I would simply say that the impression I gained from that seminar was that they were accepting with remarkably little challenge the view that all right lay on the side of the Spanish Republic. Now, I believed passionately that all, in 1936, that all right lay on the side of the Spanish Republic, and I remained a staunch supporter of them right through the rest of the war. But one has to face the fact now that the Republic had become increasingly under the control of a Stalinist Communist Party, and that as events unfolded, if the Republic had managed to hang on until the war started and had survived, you could well have had a pro-communist government in Spain, which could have been, in the long run, as ruthless as Franco was and economically a great deal less efficient. And I felt that a slightly simplistic view had reached these sixth formers, whether from their teachers in their schools, whether from the books they read, or whether those of us that held a slightly different view hadn't put that view sufficiently strongly in the seminar. But this was a position based not on talking to them, but on the absence of virtually any critical questions from them in the course of the discussions.
Could we say something about the literature which has been produced on the Spanish Civil War in the decades since? And could you tell me what your opinion is of that literature from the point of view of its accuracy, its depiction of what Spain was really like from your own personal experience in the latter part of 1936?
You've got various phases, don't you? You've got a first phase of some good war memoirs. Esmond Romilly gave a very good, clear, I thought fair picture of events at his time. There was another one by who was a member of the National Brigade. Again, I thought fair. If one then jumps a great leap to Hugh Thomas, I think Hugh Thomas, in a curious way, did a vast number of historians out of a job, because he wrote such an absolutely definitive history of the Spanish Civil War that it's pretty well killed the subject for anybody else. And I think it is a remarkable tour de force. And he manages in that to report accurately and convey this strange spirit of idealism that animated people at the time and which made people support Spain. I've become a little bit irritated by the way in which on television the issue is has been, at least in one play and at least in one memoir of a member of the National Brigade, presented as an absolutely one-sided affair. On the other hand, the Granada series, which Hugh Thomas wrote the commentary or was the historic advisor, was impeccably fair. But it seems to me, from a literary point of view, there is rather a tendency to see this an absolutely watertight case for the Republic against the opponents of the Republic. And as I say, as somebody who had held that view at the time, I'm bound to say that although I think it would have been better if the Republic had won, there's no doubt that once the appalling aftermath was over, Franco developed the economy of Spain reasonably well. But the only thing I do find, and this is that when I went back to Spain for the first time after the Civil War, and I went to that great monument to the dead in the Guadarramas, I thought this was one of the most ghastly and terrible places that I've ever seen in my life. To have had a church built by prisoners of war to honour their fellow countrymen who have been killed has something, to my mind, absolutely chilling about it. And I think there's no doubt the appalling vengeance that Franco took after the fighting is unforgivable. And the more so because I believe it was unnecessary. But nevertheless, to pretend that all virtue was on the side of the Republic is equally wrong. It was the Republic, in the name of the Republic, some terrible things were done. I still think that the Spanish people would have had a fuller and better life if the Franco revolt had not been backed by Hitler and Mussolini, and the Spaniards had dealt with it themselves, and it had been quickly got over and done with. I think one might have had a left of centre government in Spain, which would have carried out a great deal of necessary reforms, including land reform.
What did you think of the British government's non-intervention policy?
At the time, I thought it was hypocritical. I thought it was basically leaving the way for Hitler and Mussolini. And I think, deep in their bones, the British government at the time wanted Franco to win and would like them to have won quickly. And that I thought that it was a policy designed to that end.
We didn't say anything about For Whom the Bell Tolls as a work of literature from the point of view of its depiction of the Spanish Civil War and accuracy.
Well, I found it very fascinating to read, and in certain passages, absolutely true about Spain. This is mainly the earlier material in which he describes events in Madrid, and where you've got a picture of the communist operators manipulating them, things from behind the scenes. You get a terrible picture of Marty, the French man who was the worst butcher of them all, and whom I think Hemingway described as being something like the, looking rather like the grey matter you find between the claws of a very old lion. The Spaniards, the Communist Party line and the Spanish line is that this had nothing to do with realities of Spain, it was just a bit of fiction. But I would have said that if you wanted to give a complete stranger in another generation some sense of what the Spanish Civil War was like and was about, I would still think that that's quite a good piece of literature to bring to their attention. Hemingway, of course, was not a political animal at any time, and although he was warmly on the side of the Republic, there's no sign that he had any strong political feelings about them.
And he doesn't hesitate to depict Republican atrocities in the book.
No, and I think that is what gives it its authenticity. I think there is a very good picture there. The other writer who's written a good deal about Spain is Claude Coburn. Now, the sad thing about Claude Coburn is that in his writings at as Frank Pitkin, there's some very good journalism there, beautiful writing, but Claude was a communist through and through. He doesn't make that as... it's there in his autobiography if you choose to dig it out, but he doesn't proclaim it as openly as he might. And I think you've got to take Claude with a very considerable grain of salt on all these things. He was very much a proponent of the belief that truth is not an absolute, but is what helps you in the class war. But nevertheless, having said that, some of his earlier reporting is extraordinarily vivid and good. This extraordinary spirit that one felt in Spain in 1936, until the battle got bogged down and got grimmer, this sense that people were being given a chance to live to the fullest of their potential and even to live above themselves was experienced, as far as I was concerned, only on one other occasion, and this was very much the atmosphere of Britain in 1940, once Churchill had made plain that we were going to fight. There was this same exultation almost, and hand in hand with a sense of people with their minds at rest, that they were being called upon to be even better, braver, and stronger than they were. And when a country sees that for a moment, it is a very rare experience to live through. And it certainly was the case in Britain in 1940, but I'd sensed the same in Madrid in 36. Those are the only two occasions, alas, in my life in which I recall this spirit.